Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Para el British Council es un orgullo tener con nosotros en el Hey Festival a David Soloy y Evie Wild, dos de los 20 escritores menores de 40 años seleccionados como los mejores escritores británicos por la revista Granta. Esta noche los entrevistará Razia Iqbal, corresponsal de cultura para la BBC. Disfruten.
Thank you very much. Welcome everyone. It's my huge pleasure to be speaking to two more of Granta's... Shall I try again? I'm very pleased to be here to speak to two more of Granta's 20 best writers under the age of 40. The two people I'm speaking to tonight are Evie Wild and David... Say it for us.
Soloy.
David Soloy.
Is this the same?
Is that working?
Yeah. Okay. Now it is, yeah.
I'm going to focus, I don't know how many of you in the audience are familiar with their work. David has written three novels and Evie has written two. I'm going to focus on their most recent works, David's novel called Spring and Evie's novel called All the Birds Are Singing. I want to start really by putting to both of you that one of the things that struck me in your books, they're both very, very different in subject matter, but one of the things that is very present is how you write about silence and not talking about things or leaving things ambiguous and making the reader read much more. David, your book is on some levels a sort of a straightforward romance in the kind of beginnings of a romance, but it's not a romantic novel in the conventional sense at all. It's about the difficulties of people trying to get together, of falling in love. At a time, it's set in 2006, and the main character, James, is an entrepreneur who's failed at many things, having been a millionaire. And I'm, one of the things that really strikes me is how little Catherine, the girl that he thinks he's in love with, says. Can you say a little bit about the importance of writing about silence?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the situation in the novel is that Catherine is already married but separated from her husband, and her sort of emotional situation is unclear to her. I think that's true of both the characters, that their own feelings are somewhat mysterious to them, and they certainly don't have a clear sense of their own feelings. And so I was very interested in writing about a situation like that, where it wasn't so much that the characters were hiding things from each other, but that there were things which were hidden from themselves as well. A very ambiguous situation in many ways, a situation with all kinds of competing emotional attachments. And yeah, of course, I mean, in that kind of situation, people will often either say very little or say too much, or, you know, and so you do get these failures of communication of various kinds, which I was wanting to depict. So yes, I mean, the silence that exists between the characters at times, it is definitely part of that. Yeah, I mean, it's a novel about failures of communication, but which come from a lack of clarity of feeling more than a lack of clarity of expression, if you see what I mean.
Evie, in your latest novel, the main character, Jake White, is an Australian woman who, in a way, is running away from her past. And it's set in an unnamed island off the coast of the United Kingdom. But the way in which you write the novel seems to suggest all the time that she is reluctant to speak about what's happened to her past. However, through the writing of the novel, we learn what's happened to her and what it is that she's running away from. The tension required in having to withhold requires a lot of control. I wonder if you could say something about that.
Sure. I think that... Can you hear? Is that working?
It doesn't appear to be. Unless you're speaking very, very softly.
Hello? Hello, hello? Ah, excellent. There's a button that says push. should have worked that one out. So I think we've got in the West, and particularly in London, we've got a sort of feeling that the more you talk, the more things will be resolved, and the more and the better we'll feel about those things that have haunted us in the past. And I think that's true to some extent, but I also think that people tend to fall into, when they talk too much, they fall into turning everything into a story. So they keep it at arm's length. You know, they want to have, everyone's learned about closure, and everyone's learned how to, about abandonment issues and things like that. So with my character Jake, I was interested in someone who was kind of, I don't know, silence is somehow more difficult than this sort of rabbity speak that we can get when we're talking about emotions and difficult things, and things that we feel that we've done wrong. There's a lot of sort of justification or trying to work out a way that we were not in the wrong when something happened. I'm trying not to kind of give away too much, but so I just think I'm interested in people having a very difficult time, and silence seems to be something that in my family, in both my families, half of them Australian and half of them English, there's a lot of silence. There's the silence of emotional communication with my Australian family, who are macho farmers, and then there's a very kind of stiff upper lip Britishness to my dad's family. So it's something that I've always been interested in.
Let's talk in a little bit more detail about what happens in your books, because it's really only through that they're both books that rely entirely on the reader being utterly involved with the character. But with Jake White, you know, she's a young woman who is estranged from her family in Australia, rears sheep in this island, and strange things start happening to her sheep, and she doesn't quite know who is killing her sheep. So there's a sense of malevolence and foreboding in the novel, which is incredibly dark. And there were many times when I would turn a page and I would think, oh God, what's going to happen next? It's just, you know, there's this constant, it's almost like a sort of, there's a ghost that's present in the novel. And what I found extraordinary about it was that you tell that the way in which you tell the story, each chapter reveals a little bit more. There's one chapter is set in the United Kingdom, another chapter is set back in Australia. So as the novel progresses, you learn about her past. So it's a sort of retrospective going forwards. Say a little bit about why you wanted that to be the structure.
Well, so there's something very bad that happens in Jake's sort of the edge of her childhood. And I was sort of thinking about how memory works and how you can, how we avoid things that we don't want to think about. How I was talking to Nadifa Muhammad yesterday about some of the traumas that her family had faced in Somalia. And one of the things struck me so strongly about a family having to leave an elderly relative to starve to death because they were fleeing. And it was just, I was thinking about it, and it was something that I had to push away because I just couldn't, you know, it's something that you can't comprehend. And I think that when people have these very traumatic things, they do shield themselves from them. And so I was sort of, as well as trying to create a tension with the structure, I was trying to make a character that you would sympathize with, and then show you that she's perhaps done something really, really bad, and to see if that changes your view of her. So to kind of get you into her head in a way, that the reason she dislikes herself, or the reason that she buries herself away on her own,
and actually doesn't really talk to very many people at all, is very unsociable. And David, in your novel, this idea that 20-somethings, 30-somethings in contemporary London society are constantly looking for connection rather than wanting to avoid those. It seems to be at the core of that relationship between James and Catherine.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, there's a sense in which they're very self-conscious, James and Catherine, and they have a very sort of strong sense of what, it's not a clear sense, but it's a strong sense of what a relationship should be, and their own relationship is constantly being measured against that, that sort of idealized idea of a relationship. In Catherine's case, she's measuring it against a real relationship that has already happened and that is still sort of there in a way. So my novel is obviously structured more in terms of seeing the same events from the perspective of different characters. It sort of goes round in circles, my novel. The same situations tend to recur and recur and recur. So you have to keep showing them from other perspectives, otherwise it would become too boring. But
I think what happens to the reader in that structure is that the repetition and the fact that you're trying to portray each of these incidents from different perspectives means that there's a multiplicity of experiences, which is very real. It's what happens when you're starting out in a relationship and you're thinking, oh, well, what did she mean by that? There are lines in it that are so true, I'm sure, for anyone all over the world who will have embarked on a new relationship full of hope, trepidation, fear.
Yeah. Of course,
I mean, absolute fear. There's a great line in there where James says he spends most of his time thinking about, you know, what it is between him and Catherine, and on that question he is unsatiable. I love the idea that he can't get enough of being reflective, and in fact she is not as reflective.
No, she's not, because she's reflective but about a different relationship, I guess. Well, what you say is very interesting about how at the beginning of a relationship, particularly when two people don't know each other very well, they can have such divergent views of the same incident. That was quite interesting to play with. I think Catherine is very self-conscious, though. I mean, it's not, she's just...
likeable? Did you find her likeable to write?
I have great sympathy for her as a character. I regard her as, in many ways, the central character of the book. I mean, she's the character who sort of undergoes the transformative experience, even if she is different. She's in a very different place at the end of the book from where she was at the beginning, whereas James is kind of pretty much where he was in many ways. I find her a sympathetic character. I mean, did you?
I liked her a lot less than I liked James, I have to say.
Less?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, she does tend to polarise people. Some people have said that they sort of find her, that they identify very strongly with her and have a lot of sympathy for her. And there are very much two camps, a Catherine camp and a James camp.
The other thing that I think a lot of readers would take away from your novel is your unflinching attitude towards describing sexual scenes. Mm. And I wondered whether you were worried about that, because, you know, there is a bad sex award that's given in the United Kingdom for writing about sex badly. And lots of novelists fall foul of it. And I wondered why you consciously thought, I am going to tackle this.
Well, I mean, I think the nature of the subject matter, you can't write about a relationship like that and not write about the sexual content of the relationship. I mean, it's just, that would be now that we're allowed to do that, we have to do that. Jane Austen and Henry James didn't have to do that when they were writing their kind of relationship novels, because they weren't allowed to. They were probably quite happy that they weren't allowed to. We have the response, you know, we have the onus of having to do it. The Bad Sex Award is always there. It sort of looms over you as you embark on a scene like that.
I don't think you're in any, there's no chance that you're going to win it. You write about sex very accurately.
Yeah, yeah, no, no, absolutely. But I mean, in a way, it's a good thing because I think this is also the point of the award is to, you know, to make people try harder, if I can put it like that. So, of course, you have to deal with it in a very matter-of-fact way. In the end, I was happy with how that was written, and I think that those scenes work. But yeah,
let's talk about place and location because it figures very strongly in both of your novels. London for you, David, and Evie, not just the island, but when Jake thinks back on what her experiences with her family and being in Australia in a very small mining community. Mm. Being the only female amongst a bunch of very testosterone-fueled, isolated men in a community. And I wonder if you can just say a little bit about that, the potency of that location, both in terms of landscape, but also the fact that she is an isolated woman amongst men.
I think there's an isolation in that sort of landscape, the sort of dry, deserty thing where there aren't, you know, to get to the nearest town where people are getting on mixing and doing their own thing, you have to drive for several hours. I think there's a feeling of anything could happen in those situations. I had a scene in my first book, also in the desert, but with Vietnam vets, and I just find it an interesting backdrop. I find the desert sort of is like a character on its own, and the idea that you can look out and see until the horizon always fascinates me, and that you can see things coming and they can see you coming. It's a sort of exposure and isolation at the same time that I find really a sort of an amazing atmosphere to be able to write in.
Given that you are half Australian and half English, I wonder where you would locate your imaginative life then, if you have in both of your novels been drawn to that landscape.
Yeah, I definitely sort of fall back on childhood memories. You know, it's sort of the most potent memories that I have, and the places where you kind of have misunderstandings as a child that make a place even more magical. You know, I used to fall asleep in the aeroplane, so I thought Australia was just up because I never was awake for landing, and all those sorts of things, and the kind of the size difference. You know, I thought sharks, you know, would fill this room, and you just don't quite get things in the same way. Maybe your brain is a little bit more open. So I find Australia a really useful place to start. Having said that, my third book that I've just started is set solely in the UK. So it's interesting that the UK bits in the second book I found a lot harder to write. And I had to distance myself quite a lot from the landscape to get over the fact that the reality of it was just on my doorstep. And I think that's partly why it's so dark, because I kind of got into the... Britain has a very melancholy feeling to its countryside, and especially in sort of February and, you know, the dark months, it's got a real sadness and beauty. And so it's... For me, I live in London, so I have to really kind of reimagine the countryside. I don't tend to go there to kind of get inspiration. I tend to kind of mess up my memories and my images about those places.
It's fascinating that because a lot of writers would just think, well, that's quite easy. I'll get on a train or get in a car and I'll just go and expose myself to it and absorb it. So how does that process work, that you imagine yourself, or the messing up of the memories? That's a lovely turn of phrase.
It's like with keeping notebooks. I keep a lot of notebooks, and I write stuff in them all the time, but I never read them. And there's something about the process of writing down that means it goes somewhere in your head and it will come out possibly in 3 years' time as something else. And the same with photography, you know, if I'm feeling a little bit anxious about, I mean, this might sound like a bit of a sort of creative writing exercise, but I think if you go and sort of fill up your creative well, if that's not too wanky a term, by going to see exhibitions and stuff like that, and just other art forms that can kind of have, you know, that can turn a switch in you. And it's not that you will, that I get directly, it's not that I go and see a painting and go home and write based on that, but it definitely informs my feeling when I'm writing. And in the same way that, you know, photographs of places I find easier to deal with than the actual place when I'm writing.
David, you live in Hungary.
Now, yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the location of Spring, because it's set very much in London, although there are scenes outside London, because James is an entrepreneur. He's a failed dot-com millionaire, but he's not got any money anymore, and he tries his hand at making a film. There's a very comical scene at the Cannes Film Festival, or on the outskirts of the Cannes Film Festival, and also at the races. So there are locations outside London, but in many ways, the relationship between James and Catherine is reflected in the way in which you treat London.
Yeah, yeah, no, and I mean, I can't really rationalize that. It's just that I found it very interesting what Ivy was saying about finding it harder to write the UK scenes in her last book than the Australian scenes, and she was writing it in the UK, because I definitely find it easier to write about London when I'm not there. Most of this book was written in Hungary. I grew up in London. It's sort of for me, it's the sort of emotional center of the world. It will always be the sort of the most emotive place for me. It will be it has so many associations and such a sort of emotional richness. London is almost sort of my inspiration. And if I was asked what my inspiration was the other day, and it was the best answer I could give, because it's too much to say I'm only interested in stories if they're set in London, but it certainly helps. When I imagine a story, I need to imagine it in I can only imagine it in a concrete, very concrete place. So obviously, it just naturally happens that I imagine it in the place that I know the best. So I just take great pleasure from talking about London, from describing London, from trying to capture the atmosphere of London, and trying to, yeah, I mean, it, as I say, I can't rationalize it. I'm sort of floundering here trying to provide a coherent
answer. I'll step in immediately. Don't flounder. One of the things that is really wonderful about your novel is the comic scenes in it. It's very funny in parts, even though at the heart of it is this incredibly poignant, thwarting, fledgling romance. But it's very funny. Talk a little bit about the difficulty of writing funny well.
I'll probably be floundering in a minute. It's difficult to rush. I wanted to put some lighter material in the book, obviously. Otherwise, it would be too, just to prevent it being too unrelentingly sort of grim and sad. I enjoyed writing. In many ways, the comic material was easier to write. It was light relief for me as a writer as well. The scene in Cannes that you mentioned, I had so much fun writing that. It was just such a pleasure to write it. I invented a character, a friend of James's, who's the kind of main sort of comic relief provider, and he was a character I had great fun with. So yeah, I mean, it's great if you can write something and you mean it to be funny and it is funny, but it's very difficult to analyze that. It's very difficult to sort of...
Part of it, I suppose, is to do with being able to hear authentic dialogue. Because a lot of the funny bits in the book are to do with the speech. And I wonder whether you're a writer who writes down the dialogue and then says it out loud? You've got to hear it out loud?
No, I mean, the dialogue, I enjoy writing dialogue. It tends to either come easily or not come at all. If I'm having trouble with the dialogue, if it's not just sort of flowing, if I'm not just kind of writing line after line of it effortlessly, then I usually try and, you know, deal with the thing with indirect speech, or try and deal with it some other way. When I'm writing the dialogue, I write too much. I have to go back. It's too realistic, you know. It's just full of, you know, nonsense and blah blah, and I have to go back and cut some of it out. But I don't like having too much dialogue either in a novel. I don't like novels, generally speaking, which are page after page of dialogue, which are just sort of become film scripts. I have great fun with dialogue in terms
you're both
comedy.
Exceptionally successful already. You've written 3 novels, Eva, you've written 2. You're both award-winning novelists. And I wonder if you could both say a little bit about to what extent, if at all, that feels a burden.
I don't find it a burden. It's just nice. Yeah.
Good.
There's so much. I think most novelists, their problem is lacking confidence rather than having too much confidence in their work. You don't want to get complacent, of course, but it's great. And the Granta thing, for instance, was just a pretty straightforward boost.
It's fantastic, and you get so many opportunities. You get to meet other authors and travel, and that's fantastic. When it comes down to the actual job, when it comes back to writing, nothing really changes,
and
we write literary fiction, so we haven't been showered with gold or anything, but it's just, it's nice. It feels
it'll
like...
come.
Yeah, I'm sure it will. It just feels like somebody going, you're doing the right thing, and that's a really lovely feeling.
No, it's
and
great.
You work in a bookshop.
I do, yes.
And you don't see yourself giving up working in a bookshop and writing full time?
I mean, financially, I do 2 things that make next to no money, but together they make just that enough to pay the mortgage. But I love the bookshop. I run it at the minute, so that's a full-time job, really, and it's difficult and it's hard times to run a bookshop. So, it's really month by month seeing how it goes. But at the minute, I've got no plans for leaving.
What about you, David? Do you write full-time?
I live in Hungary. It's my second income kind of thing. One of the reasons I left London was because it was very difficult to live there off the income of writing only. At the moment I do.
Evie, I have to ask you, because you're so cheery and happy, and you've got a lovely smile, but your books are so full of foreboding and darkness, and I wonder where that comes from, whether that is purely something that you want to explore and it's part of your imaginative life.
Everyone's got a dark side, without wanting to sound like a chocolate advert. I think it's really important to have a sense of humour about the dark stuff as well. And I think having humour in your book enhances the dark stuff, and, vice versa. It's not like I've experienced everything in the book, but I do love, I love horror. I grew up reading Stephen King, so,
But it's funny how often you meet a writer and they're not what you expect from the books. I mean, we had, I don't want to boast, but we had breakfast with Irvin Welsh this morning, and he's the sweetest, most courteous, patient man that I've ever met. I mean, so, the books can often give a misleading impression. I mean, obviously, there's something kind of back there which is coming through in the books, but the sort of the upper levels of the writer's personality are often not directly sort of correlated with the books.
I always find that people are genuinely interested in the actual process of writing, however hard it is to talk about it, because both of you have a style of writing which is it's quite different, but it's the things that it has in common is that your sentences are short, it's very spare, that there's an awful lot that you force the reader to imagine between the spaces in the sentences. I wonder if you can both say a little bit, before I throw the questions out to the audience, about how hard won that style of writing is.
Well, you just hope that people will sort of make the connections, I guess. If you're trying to write in a way which is quite understated, if you're trying to leave gaps, and the reason I do that, I suppose, is that if I don't do that, I feel like I'm providing an unacceptably sort of crude version of the reality. If you spell everything out, then you're not really spelling everything out, actually. You're simplifying things to the point where you can spell them out.
But do you spell them out and then pare down?
No. Not really. I try to not even spell them out myself, because if I spell them out myself, then I might start to think, you know what I mean? I try and leave things in a, I mean, when I approach the story of a novel like Spring, I try to think about it as little as possible in abstract terms, and as much as possible in concrete terms. So I try to prevent myself from providing the kind of narrative, like Evie was talking about narrative, the stories that people tell themselves, the sort of self-justificatory stories, or the stories that provide some sort of rationale or coherence or whatever. Those stories always impose something on the reality, and I was very keen to avoid as little as possible. I mean, it's not, you can't avoid it totally, but avoid imposing something like that on the material, which meant partly not doing it myself.
What about you, Evie?
I suppose part of the process for me is sort of stripping back. So I write until I've got a thick manuscript, and then the real work sort of feels like in tearing everything out and saying it in as few words as possible. I think there's in sort of creative writing schools, there's this sort of thing that people say, which I think gets misunderstood, which is like, you should know what's in your character's fridges.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the time people go, right, well, in her fridge was, and they kind of, it's a weird, you know.
And is that what they taught you? Because you did an MA in creative writing.
I did. But no, my MA was much more reading based. It was a great thing. It was just a year to take myself seriously, which is not something I do all that easily. So so for me, it was really useful, and it was books that I wouldn't normally have approached, and then and deadlines really, and the opportunity to go to lots of events like this and listen to authors talk about how they write. And the main thing you learn is everyone does it very, very differently, and there's not one way of doing it. But I think that kind of, you know, there are these exercises that you can do which can give you a slightly skewed idea of what it is to write, that you need to know absolutely every single thing about a character. And I think it boils down to knowing what they want, whether it's a glass of water or to change their life or something. And I think that's what teachers are trying to get you to do when they say what's in the fridge. So
I mean, I think it's, if you can't, I mean, it's with a character, it's kind of a more holistic thing, I think. You know, you sort of, if you have to start, I mean, again, as Evie said, everyone has a different approach, so, but just speaking for myself, if I have to start trying to piece a character together out of various elements, then that never really works. I need to be able to sort of grasp the character as a whole individual, which often means thinking of somebody I know, usually someone I know very little, you know, a work colleague from 10 years ago, or an estate agent I had some dealings with, or, you know, just someone who just is a seed from which you know, you can, the character grows rather than piecing together the character out of all kinds of bits of information.
Okay, I've got more questions, but I'm going to throw it open to the floor. I'd wait for a microphone, I think, if there is somebody with a microphone somewhere. We might have to put one of these on in case they're in Spanish.
Feedback issue.
Okay, we've got a hand up at least. That's very encouraging. If we can get a microphone to the...
Muchas gracias. ¿No se oye? ¿Se oye? ¿Se oye? Muchas gracias. Quisiera preguntarles a los dos escritores cuál ha sido el momento más difícil en sus cortas carreras y si piensan seguir escribiendo por muchos años, porque vale la pena dar este ejemplo para muchas generaciones y para los adultos como yo que no pierdo las esperanzas de escribir un libro. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. I suppose the hardest bit for me was this, well, it's a large bit, but writing the second book was very difficult. The first book I wrote with no expectation that anyone would ever read it, no expectation of it being published. And then I was, while I was writing the second book, my father was very ill and I had to take 6 months off to help him and then come back to it, which was working in a very different way to the way that I'd written the first book, which was working on it every day and thinking about it every day. So I think for me, going back to the book after he died and trying to make sure that it was not a book of two halves, that it was not a book from before he died and then after he died, and getting reinvigorated about the book, That was really hard work, and that took about sort of probably a year longer than it would have taken otherwise, I think.
I suppose I would say that there isn't, each book has its own hardest moment. With all three of the books that I've written, there's been a point in the process of writing them when a very low point when it just doesn't seem to be going well and you feel that all you have is rubbish. Those moments are very difficult to get through. A sort of obsession with the subject matter is what has got me through each time, in that you come to the point where you kind of think, even if it is rubbish, I want to keep doing it just for myself and keep working on it. And then you sort of feel your way back into it, and then you realize that maybe it's not entirely rubbish and you can make something decent out of it. And on this other part of the question, I mean, I hope to be able to continue doing this, but it's a precarious existence, so you know, we'll see.
More questions? Just in the front there.
I just have a question for Evie. I've only read your first book and just read it before coming over here. I just thought it was incredible. And now you say that your experience of Australia was, you never actually lived there, you just used to go on holiday. I'm just wondering where you got the inspiration to write about this really difficult topic of sort of dysfunctionality, family, well, particularly mm-hmm. from the male experience of the three different wars. Mm-hmm. You know, if that's something that you came across on a visit, or mm-hmm. is this something that you got inspiration from reading about?
Thank you. Well, I'm half Australian, so my mother's Australian, and I've lived there for like a year at a time, but not, you know, for a solid amount. My uncle was conscripted and fought in Vietnam, so it was this big thing that sort of hung over our family that no one ever talked about, because my mother had left Australia just as he was going off to fight, and she was marching for peace in London, and he felt very betrayed by that. So there was just this big silence, really, around the war. And then when I was about 11, my cousin, who kind of, so it's kind of based on my grandfather, my uncle, and my cousin, who's about my age, my cousin tried to sort of scare the English by showing me this photo album that my uncle had put together of his time in Vietnam, and there were, you know, they were all the typical sort of rainforest and burnt out bits and machine guns, and then there were suddenly dead boys, and they were not, it wasn't something that immediately horrified me, because for me it was a fiction, it was not, you know, just didn't understand, but it was definitely something that sort of bothered away in me until I kind of learnt more about what some soldiers did in the Vietnam War and other wars, that American Marines in particular, with trophy photographs and trophy items. So that kind of bothered me more and more, because I thought of my uncle as a kind, generous, funny person. And so really the book, the parts about the war were sort of trying to explore that issue. You know, did he take these as trophies? Were they in memoriam? Or and the answer that I found was like something messy in between. You know, it, just that war changes people while they're in it, and then afterwards. And it was really sort of trying to explore that, which I only sort of found out that. I only found out that that was what I was most interested in quite far into writing the book. It sort of came to the surface again and again. And I was quite worried about writing about the war, because it's not my war. I wasn't alive for it. And I was nervous about approaching it, because it's, you know, there are a lot of people still living who fought in it, and I didn't want to go over old ground and sort of rehash sort of popular culture references to it. So it was a kind of sticky area. Korea, no one in my family ever fought in Korea, but my grandfather played the euphonium in the Second World War, so that's he was technically in it, but so I was just interested also in the that sort of heroism that you had in the earlier wars, that the only way that you could, that my grandfather's generation could really speak about that war was in the pub and being a hero, and you couldn't talk about bad stuff. You took that out on your wife and kids. So that I've sort of seen that in a lot of my family and a lot of families surrounding in Australia. Thank you.
More questions? There's a hand up just in the middle there. Do you have a microphone? No. Okay, so just go with the lady who's got the microphone. If we can get a microphone to the lady with her hand up, thanks.
Well, I have a question that is related to what you just asked, and it's actually, how can you get a part of the story you're telling without actually telling your own biography? Or because, well, I mean, like, if an author is telling a story in a certain way, you're talking about experiences that you have had. And I don't know, I've tried sometimes to write, and I always end up telling my story, you know, like my own story. So how can you actually write a book, or in which percentage are you really investing or telling your own experiences?
I'll just quickly repeat the question in case people couldn't hear it. It was about ending up, the question I said that she always ended up or often ended up writing about herself when she tried to write, I think that's correct. And how do we find telling story about telling stories about other people who aren't yourself? Or I personally find it easier to write about characters who are very distinct from myself. My first novel was set in sort of among telly salesmen in London, which was a job that I did do for a few years once. And I think my first attempt to write the novel, if I remember rightly, the main character was someone rather like myself, you know, the same sort of age and the same sort of circumstances in some ways. And it didn't really work out. It was only when I changed the main character to someone who was clearly distinct from myself that I was able to write the book in a way that I found satisfactory. So I think that there's a kind of detachment in terms of writing about characters who are clearly not you, which makes it easier in some ways. It gives you a perspective which is easier to handle, because writing about yourself, you have too much information, you're too, everything's kind of unclear. And obviously your own feelings inevitably run over that line. They cross into the character. Not only one character, obviously, in a book, all the characters essentially will be kind of feeding off the author emotionally, because you have to do that. But I would always advise people, if they want to write a book, to try and take a main character who was in some way clearly distinct from themselves.
Or if you find that you're naturally drawn, if there's a story in your life that you want to tell, but you don't want it to be about yourself, I'd say, like, take a step back from it and just think that the story is the most important bit, because sometimes things that really happened might be too sort of fantastical. They might get in the way of the actual story, even though they're a great family story. They might just stand in the way. They might be too much.
I think it's really interesting that both of you, when you talk about writing, you talk about the compulsion to write, particularly you, David, and you that. Because I'm sure a lot of people would think, well, do writers have readers in mind? And yet you are saying, actually, you would carry on doing it because you have a compulsion to do it.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's... Yeah, no, I did say that. But and that was true. But I enjoy it. So I do it, I do it even if no one was paying me and no one was prepared to publish it. I think I do it just for my own amusement. But... I do also have a reader in mind, not a sort of abstract or idealized reader or myself reader. I think it might have been you, Evie, the other day saying that people write books for themselves in the sense they write the sort of book that they would like to read. Mm-hmm. And that's very much the case, because I do always think of the reader when I'm writing and how you can... What the reader's responses will be, what the reader's emotional responses will be, what the reader's expectations will be, because obviously playing with the expectations of the reader is what it's all about, really. And it's a sort of there's a sort of complicity, which as a reader I greatly enjoy reading a book, to sort of when the author almost kind of winks at you and says, I'm doing, when it's not like you're being tricked into this, it's a game that you're playing with the author. You're enjoying being manipulated. And I enjoy that aspect of it as well, which is very much a sort of reader-writer aspect and not just sort of talking into a void.
I think we've got time for one more question. You've got the microphone.
I guess my question is on a similar theme, because the psychological nature of your work does beg questions about relationships and emotional expression. And I suppose just developing that theme, I did wonder, after you have written a book, even though you may have said this is a person who's completely different to me, I think it has to be to a certain extent an expression of your own inner world, on that other person. Whether you find that you have changed slightly, that your relationships with people are different, that you relate differently to people, that you have resolved something in some way.
I suppose there's a sort of clarity. I mean, it's sort of like writing a book involves thinking. It's a sort of way of thinking, in a way. By sort of thinking about a certain situation for so many hours and sort of going into it in such minute detail, a sort of clarity emerges. But I don't know if it's always difficult to tell as well whether you'd have just changed anyway, or whether it was because of the process of writing the book. I mean, obviously, I'm a different person now. The book took, say, 2 years to write. I was a different person the end of that 2 years from at the beginning, but I suppose undoubtedly you can't write a book without being changed by the process of writing it. I wouldn't claim that it's made me in any way sort of wiser or better at relationships, unfortunately, no.
But it's hard to imagine that it wouldn't change you, because the expectation in the writing of it as a novelist is that it will be a transformative experience for the reader.
Oh, I mean, that would be a big, I mean, you know, that would be nice, but I mean, that would be a very grand expectation to have, I think.
It's a great one to have, though, right?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I don't know. In a way, it's not for me to say, perhaps. As I say, a kind of clarity. I feel a kind of clarity in my perception of things now, or a greater clarity. But whether it was a sort of totally transformative experience, perhaps not. I mean, I don't want to kind of, you know, play it down too much. I mean, yes, it's, you know, whatever. But I'm happy if people find it transformative, but it was interesting.
Anyone's got another question, I think we have run out of time. So if you would put your hands together and thank both David and Evie, and go and buy their books.
Thank you.